the Institute on Religious Life and the Daughters of St. Mary of Providence of Chicago, bring you the last in a series of conferences given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J. on the theme, The History of Religious Life. Father John Hardin is a professor of theology at St. John's University in New York. He is a well-known lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin is the author of many articles and books, including Holiness in the Church and the Catholic Catechism, which has been strongly endorsed by Holy Mother Church. In this last lecture, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Religious Life in the Light of the Second Vatican Council. Father Hardin.
I thought I would say something about religious life since the Second Vatican Council. I would like to look at it from three viewpoints. First, to identify the principal documents of the Church during and since the Council, from which the both present status and future prospects of religious life somehow will stem. Then very briefly look at the problems whose number is legion and whose solution is known to God alone but have entered religious life since the Council. And then something about the renewal and adaptation that is going on and that shows great promise into the years to come. First, therefore, the Church's own teaching on religious life. From the pontificate of John the 23rd to the present day, we have record, and we have, I'd say, the only record in the world of all the documents issued by the Holy See somehow touching on religious life. The actual number that Father Coccini gave me is 1,227 documents. It is then a library, so that whatever problems there are in religious life, and no one doubts there are many, they do not stem from the fact that the Church has not been either clear enough or forceful enough or insistent enough as to what religious life should be. The teaching is there. However, there are six documents especially that I would single out that bear emphasis, excluding the seventh, which has just come out last year, but up to 1978, there were six. Let me give you the titles, either in Latin or English, as the case might be, and say a few words about each. Because I would ask you, anticipating whatever the Lord will provide next year, that you familiarize yourselves with at least some of the basic documentation. The first and fundamental document is the Constitution on the Church, Lumen Gentium, chapters 5 and 6. Chapter 5 is the chapter on holiness, the universal call to sanctity. Chapter 6 is on religious life. The Constitution, Lumen Gentium as it is called, gives us the doctrinal basis for the religious life, the first time in the history of Christendom. never in 2,000 almost years has an ecumenical council of the Church set forth in concise, clear terms what, based on divine revelation and the Church's teaching, what is religious life. Much of the knowledge that I have about the doctrine on religious life, especially as emanating from the Council, I received from Father Joseph Russo, an oblate who had been secretary of the Sacred Congregation for Religious prior to the Council and during it, and then was secretary of the Conciliar Commission on Religious Life. He told me there were 80 meetings of bishops and superiors general, that is, prior to the actual convening of the council. He told me the original plan, well, there were really two plans, and they were opposed to each other. There was a group of bishops, a minority, but nevertheless a strong minority, that felt that religious life should not have any special document of the Second Vatican Council. They had precedent on their side because there had never been. In any case, then the question arose, once that was decided that there will be documentation, will it be one single document dealing with both doctrine and norms, with both what religious life is and how it should be lived, but the method that prevailed was to separate the doctrine of what religious life is from how it's to be lived by placing the doctrine inside the Constitution on the Church. There was talk, as you may know, about a special document in Our Lady. The decision was to place it inside the Constitution on the Church, so that for all times the Universal Church has, you might say, canonized religious life as being part and parcel of the Church. As long as there will be a Catholic Church, faith tells us there always will be till the end of time, there will be religious. Comforting thoughts, especially nowadays. Yes, that's the doctrine, especially in Chapter 6. Perfecti Caritatis, issued by the same council, is then the normative or legislative side of the Council's teaching on how religious life should be lived. Unlike, therefore, the Constitution, it is called a decree, where Lumen Gentium in Chapter 6 is addressed to the mind to enlighten those, all the faithful in fact, and especially religious themselves, as to what this life is. The decree Perfecti Caritatis is directed to the will, informing them and motivating them on how they should live up to the doctrine already declared. The third document was Ecclesiae Sanctae. Ecclesiae Sanctae was a document specially issued by Pope Paul VI in what is called a motu proprio. That means a document that the Pope, first of all, himself, wants written, very specially involves himself in its composition, and places the full weight of his papal authority behind. This document, motu proprio Ecclesiae Sanctae, was the implementation of four decrees of the Second Vatican Council. The document was issued in 1966, to be exact, August the 6th, the anniversary by anticipation of Pope Paul's death. The document therefore implements, first, the decree on bishops. Secondly, the decree on priests. Third, the decree on the missions. And fourth, the decree Perfecti Caritatis. But since religious are under the bishops, and not a few religious are bishops, the document on the bishops, implemented by Ecclesiae Sancti, also deals with religious life, since not a few priests are religious, and all religious depend on the priesthood. A large part of that implementation on the priesthood also deals with religious life. Since most missionaries are religious, a very large part of the implementation of Ad Gentes, which is the Latin name for the document on the missions, also deals perforce with religious. But it's especially Perfecti Caritatis that, in being implemented by Paul VI, gives us the highest ecclesiastical authority on how religious life is to be lived. The logical sequence, therefore, for religious is Lumen Gentium chapter 6, that is dogma. Perfecti Caritatis of the Second Vatican Council, that is decree, legislation of the aforesaid dogmatic chapter. And Ecclesiae Sanctae is the explaining how you put Perfecti Caritatis into practice. Those three documents should always be seen as one logical whole. Lumen Gentium, Perfecti Caritatis, and Ecclesiae Sancti. It is in Ecclesiae Sancti that the Holy Father set down the norms for how the renewal and adaptation legislated by Second Vatican should be done. And it is because of the neglect of Ecclesiae Sancti that so many communities throughout the Catholic Church are in grave difficulty, and not a few struggling for survival. Because the Pope couldn't have been clearer, and I repeat, the full weight of papal authority is behind it. The principal agent for the renewal and adaptation of religious life in the modern world is the General Chapter. That's Ecclesiae Sancti. Well, then the Pope says there is to be renewal and adaptation, but renewal is first and it's primary. Adaptation is very secondary. Renewal has to do with a change of the inside spirit of the community, of its union with God, its pursuit of holiness. Adaptation is in the external order, adjusting such external features of religious life as is necessary, well, to fit into our day. But let not, he said, adaptation be of the price of sound renewal. But then he further said, no chapter is empowered, it doesn't have the power, doesn't have the authority to change the spirit of the community to change the purpose for which the community was founded, to change its constitutions in anything which is substantive. No chapter has that authority. And it's there so much folly has been perpetrated. Chapters, assuming to themselves authority they never had, and which the Pope couldn't have been clearer in stating they didn't have, proceeded to do exactly what they didn't have a right to do. Change the substance of the constitutions, the spirit and charism of the community, and the purpose for which it was founded. The Pope further said, the guiding light in whatever renewal or adaptation is done by the chapters must be the charism of the founder, which, and having been doing this for almost 15 years, I can tell you many communities, the last thing they concern themselves with, except maybe a pious footnote somewhere about the founder, the Pope said, is to be the guiding star of its renewal and adaptation. So much for Ecclesiae Sanctae. The fourth document, consciously made tentative, was Renovationis Causam. The purpose of this document was not to once and for all change the method of formation of those who are entering religious life. It did, however, open up, as many here know, aspects and features that were quite different. But whatever Renovationis Causam taught, and it taught a great deal, it insisted that the principal purpose of that early formation in religious life is to build a solid spiritual foundation. The very title of the document, Renovationis Causam, can be translated into English roughly as for the purpose of renewal, where renewal in the Church's concilial language relative to religious life always refers to the inner spirit, to the life of prayer, to the practice of virtue. The fifth document was Venitis Orsum, addressed to the contemplatives in the Catholic Church. Venite Seorsum, Venite Seorsum, which may be loosely translated as come away for a while, draw away from the world in which you are living, and, well, engage in prayerful contemplation. The document is still the guiding star of those who wish to live the contemplative life according to the mind of the Church. Venitis Orsum builds on the teaching of both Lumen Gentium and Perfectitari Caritatis relative to cloistered contemplatives. Let me just mention three things about this relative to all of us. First, this document, though it is sometimes loosely called the document for contemplatives, made clear that all religious are to be contemplative. But that secondly, among religious, but life of contemplation in cloister, so that properly speaking, the Niti Siorsum is directed not to contemplatives, but rather to cloistered contemplatives. And if thirdly, spelled out in the most explicit terms of how that cloistered contemplative life is to be lived. The norms of the Niti Siorsum are obligatory on all cloistered contemplatives, but sadly, as we shall see when we touch on the problems within the last half hour that we still have left, not all cloistered contemplatives have seen fit to abide by these norms. And finally, well, prior to the document of last year was Evangelica Testificatio of Paul VI, the apostolic exhortation, which I understand from the French Dominican, who was the principal assistant of the Holy Father in drafting the document, he came to Chicago and we spent a day together. He told me, my broken French and here's better English, helped by an interpreter, we managed to carry on what was for me a very profitable conversation. The Pope's original plan was not what finally was published. It was, so he said, to have issued an encyclical on the religious life, which was to have included at the end certain decrees, in effect telling the religious of the world, take it or leave it. In any case, there was strong representation to the Pope not to issue that forthright black and white document, and I understand that my general was largely responsible for convincing Pope Paul to rather publish what he did. In any case, Evangelica Testificatio gives us all the positive doctrine about the religious life, but minus those strongly worded norms or decrees. If you don't do this, this or that will happen. It is a very paternal document. It is kind. It is also very clear. Finally, and this document does not have a Latin title, at least not known by such, it is rather Directives of the Holy See on the Relationship Between Bishops and Religious, published in 1978. It is a long document and spells out what rights bishops have, what rights religious have, what duties each has. Tells the bishops to understand religious life better than they do. Tells religious to better understand the responsibility of bishops than they do. It has norms telling each how they should deal with the other. So this document on the relationship of bishops and religious promises to be a very important practical document on the countless ways in which they can and should cooperate for the upbuilding of the mystical body, and how they should not interfere. And this is a new language which, with each other's charism, the bishops are told, you got your charism. Religious are told, you have yours. Both are from the same Lord. In the name of that same Lord, please cooperate. So much for documentation. Now, a necessary few words about problems. I might begin by quoting Father Heiser, who is the Undersecretary of the Sacred Congregation for Religious, who is coming to the United States this August and will be staying here. As he told me some time ago in my conversation that I had with him in Rome, that among the remarks we make about the work we are trying to do in Rome for religious, that sometimes jokingly we say we are not so much the Sacra Congregazione for religiosos. In other words, we are not so much the sacred congregation as the Sacra Clinica for religiosos. Which, being translated, would be, well, the sacred hospital for religious. There are so many disabled communities that just binding their wounds or staunching their bleeding veins keeps the Holy See busy in such a way that other work often has to be left undone because of the problems in religious communities in countries like America. What are some of the problems? I don't have these in the sequence in which I would consider them relatively important. I would put secularization first. It is a large subject, but as might be expected, in a society that is secularizing in so many ways, it is no wonder that that spirit of the world, which is what secularization is, should have penetrated even the thickest monastic walls. Secularization. When you apply so many things that it is not my business here to expand on, except to say that somewhere beneath it is a loss of faith. Second, activism. Over the years, the Church has been warning her religious time and again not to neglect a life of prayer for the sake of the apostolate. Yet, with not a few communities, those warnings have gone unheeded. Activism is the neglect of prayer in order to engage in, you name it what, otherwise worthwhile apostolic enterprise. Third, this is not so much a problem as a symptom of a cluster of problems, polarization.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.